Hey, welcome to your turn, Mike Causey. Glad to have you with us. We're going to be talking about some really interesting stuff today, very important financially for federal workers and retirees. My first guest is David Snell. He's Director of Retirement Services for the National Active and Retired Federal Employees Association. David, thank you for being with us.
Good morning, Mike. Good to be here.
You're fresh from vacation in South Carolina, huh?
Absolutely.
Outstanding. Okay. All right. Well, now it's time to get back to work. Cast aside those things. David, awful lot of people are interested in phased retirement. Among them, our web editor, Mike O'Connell, who's going to be writing up this broadcast. And so I wanted to ask you about that. I noticed that there was a story August 13th in the Baltimore Sun about the phased retirement. What is a phased retirement, and where are we now with it?
Okay. Phased Retirement Act is an idea that OPM came up with. In fact, the former director, John Barry, did, that would allow folks to kind of ease out of retirement, ease out of work and into retirement. The thought behind it is that with a lot of institutional knowledge going out the door from the federal government, that if a phase type of a retirement could be available, these folks who are in the middle of working on a project or whose institutional knowledge is such that it would take time to get a new employee
sort of up to speed,
on it, up to speed, that they could continue to work and at the same time draw part of their pension. The regulations that the Office of Personnel Management have drawn up allows for 50% part-time work by the employee, and at the same time they would receive 50% of their retirement. And in that way, these folks could ease out, could pass down their institutional knowledge, still receive, enough money to live on, be helping the government in passing on that institutional knowledge.
Well, you know, I've heard from so many people in and out of government that they don't want to retire completely, but they would like to get a taste of it, and the ideal for them would be to work 2 or 3 days a week. Is that how this phased retirement plan would work? Is there a set number of days they would work?
Well, they can't work more than 50% half time.
Okay.
So it would be a 40-hour pay period,
2020, huh?
Yeah, 2020, and a big portion of that must be used in mentoring another employee, someone presumably who will be taking that senior employee's place when they do finally decide to retire. Now, at this moment, the Office of Personnel Management, they have put the proposed regulations out for comment. They did that in July. The comment period, I believe, was over August 5th. And it will be probably toward the end of the year that OPM, and that's optimal, before OPM releases the final regulations on this. So in the meantime, agencies are kind of waiting, and there is no phased retirement. So I would say that it won't probably be effective until early next year.
Right. Well, in her piece in the Baltimore Sun, Eileen Ambrose wrote that she said almost 75,000 people retired between January and July of this year. So that's an awful lot of people. That's up about 31% from a year ago. And I would think that if you have this phased retirement plan up and running by the end of this year, or certainly the start of 2014, that this retirement tsunami we've been predicting for the last decade plus could actually hit us, because you're going to be able to get credit for sick leave, too, starting in January, aren't you?
Oh, yeah. The first folks will get all their sick leave credited for service. So, we'll see how this goes. I'm hopeful. As you point out, there have been a lot of people asking about it. Once it becomes available, we'll see if how many people actually take advantage of it.
Yeah, I know of several instances in the government where people who have retired have been called back to their agencies to work a couple of days a week on this very kind of thing, this both archiving and mentoring and whatnot.
Right, yeah, and it works well. I mean, on paper, it sounds great. It stems the tsunami with all the knowledge going out the door, and at the same time provides a way to ensure that continuation of knowledge and skill.
Okay. Yeah. I know that's a lot of people are looking forward to that. It's one of those things we thought would never happen. And as you said, it's a tribute to John Barry, who's now the new U.S. ambassador to Australia. But he was really down in the weeds with this federal personnel stuff. And this was one of the, I guess this was one of the monuments to him.
Well, I'm sure he's, when he gets to Australia, it'll be a smile on his face to look back and see that this has actually become a reality.
Well, and the worst job of the OPM director, too, no matter what anybody thinks, the worst job is in the winter when you have to make the weather calls in Washington. that's make or break time.
Oh, absolutely.
John Barry got burned a couple of times himself on it.
I don't know of a director that hasn't.
Yeah, that's right. This month's NARF magazine, the cover story is a fascinating one. I read it literally cover to cover. It's called Don't Take the Bait. And it's these pension advance offers that a lot of retirees are getting. And you see the ads on cable TV all the time. But do you have a structured settlement or an annuity? How do these scams work? And I guess most of them are scams.
Well, I wouldn't want to paint that broad brush stroke on everybody that offers these. What it is these companies are offering what they call pension advances. In other words, they'll give you cold, hard cash now in return for part of your pension for the next whatever months to pay it back. The problem here is that there are so many unscrupulous companies that will have a lot of hidden fees that would, especially in the area of interest rates, that you're going to have to pay these so-called advances back, and what they are is really loans. They call them advances to get around certain parts of the law, but they're really, in essence, loans. And older folks, especially after having gone through this last 3 or 4 years of recession, may be desperate in some cases to get their hands on some cash. We know the banks have been reluctant, shall we say, to loosen up their loans and allow these folks to get them. So these predatory type lenders are out there in the waters looking for bait. And they're finding it in the retirees. Retirees often have these defined benefit plans where they know how much they're going to have coming in. They're good targets for these companies. But the hidden costs can drive these folks further into debt in the future. They have, what I've read, they've estimated there's interest rates are from 27 to over 100%. And they're taking advantage, basically, of people's tendency to spend more than they can afford now at the expense of their future.
Well, I noticed, too, in the article, it said that many of these companies require you to take out a life insurance policy from them. So that's another way they hit you. And also, I wouldn't want a perfect stranger having a $200,000 life insurance policy on me. I'd be looking over my shoulder a lot.
It's a good point. That's another one of those hidden hooks that they have. And of course, once you buy the life insurance policy, I'm sure that there's all kinds of caveats to it that would prevent you from being able to get out of that deal. So, as a matter of fact, I remember there was some complaints from folks in Panama that gotten into some kind of situation with furniture sellers, furniture retailers, who required those folks to have their annuities direct deposited to accounts that the furniture company had actual control over. And, you know, that's another way these companies are skirting the law, because under the law, federal annuities cannot be assigned. You can't just assign your annuity over to anybody unless there's a court order that directs you to do so. So some of these companies are asking folks to change their direct deposit so the money goes into an account they control, which is even more dangerous.
Absolutely.
You would think folks, you know, gain wisdom when they age. But again, economic stress is such that people do desperate things, and they don't always work out for the best for them.
Yeah, that is absolutely scary. Need to take a short break here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Be right back. Mike Causey, welcome back to Your Turn. Glad to have you with us. And we're talking with David Snell. He's Director of Retirement Services for the National Active and Retired Federal Employees Association. Dave, I know in Washington, some of the very best lobbyists, and I say that not just because I know them, but I've worked with all kinds, but some of the very best lobbyists work for and represent federal and postal workers, retirees, managers, and whatnot. It's an extremely tight, tough cadre of people, and they can take anything you throw at them, just about. But the one thing you can strike fear into their hearts is if you use the term chained CPI, for chained consumer price index. And I know that's a top legislative priority of NARF. Could you tell us why people should be nervous about this?
Yes, I can. And I'm glad you brought it up, Mike. People are voicing a lot of concern about Affordable Care and the FEHB, FEHB reform and that sort of thing. But the one thing on the horizon for retirees that will affect them, and that is the proposal in Congress to change the way the cost of living is calculated from a CPI urban wage earner formula to a chain CPI. And this is going to affect current employees when they retire. It's going to affect current retirees. It's going to affect survivors of those retirees, because those survivors will also see a loss in the amount of inflationary protection that will be offered if the CPI, the chain CPI, is enacted.
Right. Excuse me. This consumer price index, too, just to identify it. This is the thing that triggers cost of living adjustments for not only federal retirees and military retirees, but a lot of veterans' benefits, and most importantly, the huge number of people who get Social Security benefits.
It right.
would, as I understand it, it would shave future increases each year by about 0.3%. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. About 0.3%, and which doesn't sound like a whole bunch, but if you understand the fact that people are going to be retired for almost as long as they have worked, and that over a period of 20, 25 years, that 0.3% is going to equate into tens of thousands of dollars for the retiree, then you understand the importance that the chain CPI not be enacted into law.
Yeah, it's compounding in reverse, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And we are urging everybody, all retirees, but especially NARF members, to contact their congressman the week of September 16th. That's our Contact Congress week. And voice their adamant refusal to have the chain CPI take away their future benefits.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but the Obama administration has endorsed this, hasn't it?
Yes, it has.
Okay, I mean, that to me is critical, because if it was only a proposal of House Republicans, which many of these are, you'd say, well, we're going to continue with the stalemate. But this was part of the Simpson-Bowles Commission recommendations, which also included the two-year, which then stretched to three-year federal pay freeze.
Right.
So this is a sleeper out there, but it's got the White House backing and considerable congressional backing. And I would think from a politician's point of view, this is a dream come true, because it will save a tremendous amount of money. But it's the kind of thing that it's very hard for people to understand. And once it's implemented, as you said, people will barely notice it. I mean, you really won't notice it, because you get what you get. And so it's from a politician's standpoint, this is a dream come true.
Oh, sure. It's not going to hit anybody in the face right away.
Yeah.
And people will shrug and say, okay, well, you know, 0.03. But over a period of time, and as I said, you know, for federal retirees who elect survivor benefits, those survivor benefits are also subject to these cost of living increases. And so if something happens to them, their survivors are also going to see a less of a yearly increase than they would normally under the current CPI. So, it has a lot of effect over a period of years, and it's no way to secure your future in retirement.
David, have you been, I know you worked at OPM for many years in retirement, have you been tracking this plan in the president's budget that would set up a self plus one option within the federal employee health program? In other words, now you can either get single coverage or family. Doesn't matter if your family is only two people, it's single or family. And they've proposed setting up a self plus one, meaning those two people would pay a different premium than people who have a family of three or four or five.
Yes, and as a matter of fact, NARF is part of the FEHB Reform Advisory Committee that OPM has set up. It constitutes not only organizations like NARF, but a lot of unions. So we have met with OPM on their proposed legislation. One of the areas that they want the law to be changed in is to allow a self-plus-one option. The reason behind these reforms, the FEHB program wants to foster more competition from other health insurance carriers and also to reduce program costs. Now, you know, it'll save the program money maybe, but will it save the individual money? And that's the important question here. NARF would like to see more data to make sure that this self-plus-one option is not going to result in an adverse risk selection, causing some enrollees' premiums to increase while others decrease. So we have asked the Office of Personnel Management to provide us some kind of data that would assure us that this isn't going to affect the big pool that federal employees and retirees and survivors and dependents, 8 million of them make up now under the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program.
Well, and the FEHBP is certainly one of the best health plans, if not the best program in the country, and it's especially good for retirees because they pay the same premiums in the same plans as young, healthy workers.
Right.
So I can see why you're concerned that adding another group to this risk pool could adversely affect older workers.
Yeah,
older workers and retirees.
Right. If it splinters the risk pool up, I mean, if it creates a different risk pool, if the population of that self plus one is by far older retirees whose dependents are no longer eligible mm-hmm. for coverage. We all know that older retirees cost the program more. And if if the majority of people that move into that self plus one are going to be the older retirees, we're going to see an effect on the premiums. So, a lot of folks think, well, it's obviously got to be lower than the family, but I'm not too sure that we'll have to see.
That's really interesting that you'd say that. I must say I'd never thought about it, because in the past when people have made arguments for self plus one, they seem to me to have been younger workers mm-hmm. who maybe had a partner or a spouse, but they didn't have kids, didn't plan to have kids, or for whatever reason, but they wanted the benefits of a group plan, but they wanted it tailored to their particular situation. But I can see where it would boomerang.
Yes, it could. Right now the self-only option for most plans is about half of what the family option is in terms of premiums.
Yeah.
Now, interestingly enough, I was looking at the California state benefit program.
CalPERS.
CalPERS is what it's called. And I noticed that the premiums for self-only were about half of what they were for the self-plus-one. Now, the self-plus-one premiums were several hundred dollars, lower than the family. But right now, we have that kind of ratio between self and family. I'm just wondering, how this is going to play out. OPM says it's going to save money. I'm just wondering whose money it's going to save.
Well,
is it going to save enrollees, or is it going to save the program?
Good for a lot of people at NARF is on the advisory committee. Thank you, David Snell, for being with us. We'll get back to you in a couple of weeks and bring things up to date. Meantime, we take a short break here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Welcome back to Your Turn, Mike Causey. We had a good discussion earlier with David Snell from the National Active and Retired Federal Employees about the chain CPI, the chain COLA. If you missed it, or if you want to pass it on to a friend, remember it is archived on our homepage. You can get it and listen to it anytime. My next guest is Sean Riley. He's lean, mean, rested from vacation, back with his old job at the Federal Times. Sean, are you with us?
I'm here. How you doing,
good.
Mike?
I'm good, good. Whoever said August was a dull month in the news was not talking about August 2013.
Well, I think we can look back. We can also compare it to the days when Congress used to get out or call it quits long before Christmas. And nowadays, of course, they go straight up through the holiday season. So it's a different world we're living in.
It really is. And one of the most confusing things, and maybe you can set us straight on this, is the status of the 2014 federal pay raise. We've had the FEPCA law, the Federal Employees Pay Comparability Act of 1990, that has never really worked. The first president to access it was Bill Clinton, and it didn't work with him. He lowballed the figures each year, I believe, and the first year he proposed a zero pay raise, even though the law was supposed to guarantee a small but steady increase each and every year. George W. Bush followed suit on that and recommended lesser raises for the most part, and now we're in an era where we've had three straight years of pay freeze for the white-collar people. What are they looking for in 2014?
Well, the president and the Senate in their proposed 2014 budgets have proposed a 1% increase for federal civilian employees. And last week, the president, sent a letter to Congress essentially saying he wanted to go ahead and provide that 1% increase starting in January, and this presumably be through executive order. But that presumes still that Congress won't weigh in, and the chances are pretty good that Congress will weigh in one way or another, and they would have to appropriate the money somewhere down the road. And we're probably talking about around, I guess, $2 billion is what this would cost. The House has not put that increase in its budget. Darrell Issa, who's head of the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, whose purview includes the federal workforce, has said he doesn't think an increase is necessary. So I think even among federal employee advocates, there's some pessimism about whether this is actually going to go through. As you know, last year the president proposed a 0.5% increase. I think, as I recall, that would have been the smallest ever on record, or at least since the 50s, and that got that got lost in sort of the larger budget frame, you know, the outcome of budget negotiations, and so was never implemented, which means, as you alluded to, we're in the third year of a freeze on federal pay scales.
Well, and if something is going to happen or if something isn't going to happen, is it possible that we won't know by January 1st?
Very much so. I mean, there was, as you know, there's the likelihood is, you know, there's an overwhelming likelihood that Congress will not have acted on any of the appropriations bills, or given final approval, I should say, to any of the appropriations bills for FY14 by October 1st, and it's very possible they may not have done that by January. So it could, you know, it could be up in the air for well into next year.
So the January pay raise, if any, could be in March.
Possibly, I think. Isn't that refresh my memory on this? Isn't this essentially? Wasn't the scenario outlined last year or by the president when he proposed holding off on the increase until there was a final deal on appropriations?
I had forgotten that. You're right. Yeah, that's true.
And so that went on. I mean, I think it would have, if it had taken effect, it would have kicked in around March when they finally reached an agreement on full-year spending levels.
Now, what if we go into a continuing resolution scenario whereby they say keep operating at last year's levels, which in effect means operating at the year before because we've been on a continuing mm-hmm. resolution for several years now. What if they do that again, go to a continuing resolution situation? What kind of impact would that have on the federal pay raise, if any?
Well, presumably, I mean, Congress can write these CRs any way it wants, and they could include, although I would say the chances are not very good, they could include some, you know, some language in there allowing for a pay raise. But if it is a straight CR or more or less straight CR, you're not going to see a pay raise.
Right. And the numbers we're talking about here, the president proposed 1%, flat 1%,
mm-hmm.
and the I think the Senate Armed Services Committee and maybe the full House, or I may have this reversed, had approved a 1.8% raise for the military,
mm-hmm.
but nothing for civilians. Is that correct?
I believe the Senate does include a 1% increase. I don't know about armed services, but the Senate has appropriated or has included in its budget, and I think this is included in the appropriations bill for the DOD civilian workforce, a 1% increase. So they seem committed, you know, these Senate Democrats, you know,
yeah.
who are in the majority seem committed to that.
Okay, very good. Well, I guess the bottom line is if you're not confused, you haven't been paying attention.
Right.
This is very complicated stuff.
It is, and I certainly wouldn't. I guess the bottom line is don't bank on that pay raise at this point.
Yeah, don't spend it. Don't spend it. The news of the day, the news du jour here, is that FEA, the Federal Employee Education and Assistance Fund, has suspended the interest-free loans it had given out to thousands of federal workers because of the furloughs.
Actually, you're telling me something I was not aware of. I knew that they had significantly increased demand and attributed to the furloughs. As I recall, the FEA provides, I think, $1,000 loans to cover you know, really pressing needs. I mean, talking like, you know, utility bills, that kind of thing. And, you know, they didn't have a huge budget. I mean, considering you were talking about, you know, roughly around 800,000 federal employees who were furloughed at some point in the last few months. And then, of course, you had all the DOD furloughs taking place since July. They were facing some pretty big demands, and I don't think their fundraising was able to keep pace.
Right. They had some very generous contributions from corporate sponsors, Geico, Blue Cross, long-term care partners, et cetera. But that's a drop in the bucket when you look at the demand from people. Of course, what happened was FEA, you know, being a government, a feds helping feds charity, they needed documentation. So you couldn't just write them or email them and say, send me $1,000, things are going to get tough. They needed documentation that your pay had actually been docked because of the furlough, and then they needed documentation as to what bills you were having trouble meeting, and then they would make a check out to that particular, you know, if it's the power company or the light company or for food.
Right, or for rent, things like that.
Yeah,
I mean, they don't. Yeah, it should be clear on this, and that they do not. The way they've explained it to me is they don't send. You know, they won't write an individual federal
yeah.
employee a check. They'll write a check to cover expenses, but it'll go directly to the creditor.
Yeah, that's just like people back in their college days. But this has got to be for real. Well, yeah, Steve Bauer, the director of FEA, announced announced last week that they were running out, and we're reporting this morning that they have stopped the loans. So that's a definitely a sign of the times. And of course, what happened? I guess the IRS started first, but there was a two and a half week lag before people started getting those checks that were light, 20% light for that week, or in the case of Defense Department employees, 20% light for 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm, right. Well, I think, and of course, that tends to be, you know, at least from what I've read and talking to federal, you know, DOD employees, I mean, you know, the impact is cumulative. When you're, you know, 20% short on a paycheck for 1 week, then it makes it more difficult to meet expenses the next. It just kind of builds up. And even though DOD is now, as your listeners know, has halted the furloughs early, they've stopped at 6 days instead of 11. You know, the impact, I think, is still being felt among, you know, particularly sort of the lower end of the GS schedule and the wage grade employees in DOD.
Oh, yeah. It's been very tough for a lot of people. Sean, we need to take a short break here, but when we come back, I want to ask you about what the Postal Service is up to now. We'll be right back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, federalnewsradio.com. Welcome back to Your Turn. I'm talking with Sean Riley, a senior writer with the Federal Times, and he just gave a masterful explanation of the 2014 pay raise, federal pay raise, the to be or not to be federal pay raise. Sean, I know you keep a sharp eye on the Postal Service, and this morning Tom Timmon on the Federal Drive was outlining a story that Federal Times broke about the Postal Service rolling out 175,000 mobile phones to collect real-time data. And that sounded interesting. I'm not exactly the Mr. Tech around here, but I know that UPS and FedEx, part of the joy is that you can track items and find out where they are. Is that where the Postal Service is heading?
Yes, it is. This is actually a very interesting story, particularly for the folks who, you know, still tend to think of the Postal Service as a low-tech organization. And I have to credit my colleague Andy Medici for breaking this mm-hmm. story. But what they're doing is they're basically giving out about 175, or they plan to deploy about 175,000 mobile phones. And, you know, keep in mind the post, that's pretty much be one phone for just about every letter carrier, I think.
I think that's
or close
right.
to
yeah.
it. And, you know, the idea is essentially to allow them to do real-time tracking of, you know, of deliveries and, you know, where they go, what time they're delivered. They've had that. They've had the ability to scan that information in, but not in real time. So this is going to be a much more instantaneous thing when this is completely implemented than it has been in the past.
Now, is this for packages and a special service? I mean, I'm not going to be able to call and say or check in and say I'm expecting a letter from Sean Riley. Where is it? And they'll say, oh, it's down at Mrs. Connor's house. They're walking past right now, and they'll be at your place in 10 minutes. It's not going to be like that.
I don't think it's going to be quite that yeah. To the moment, but it definitely would be for packages and allow people to know exactly when those where what the status of that package is and where you know when it actually arrives to where it's supposed to go. And this they're supposed to have this these cell phones on place by the end of this month. And this is the I guess one in a number of steps they're taking to enhance their ability to do this technologically.
Well, if their rates are compatible or if they compete well with FedEx and UPS, this could be a great leap forward because right now they give you a tracking number, but it really is something to be used in case it's lost or to sort of walk back the cat.
That's right. And, I mean, and you've got to keep in mind that the package business is becoming an increasingly important source of revenue for the Postal Service. You know, traditionally, first-class mail
yeah.
has been the big moneymaker. That has been declining for years now. And but their package and shipping business has been really growing quite robustly, and as a result, I think you're seeing them place more attention on it, and that's why I've got to assume that's one big reason why they're putting these phones in place because they want to keep building on that.
You know, just looking at this Federal Times story, at Andy's story, 175,000 mobile phones. This is a reminder that we ought to step back and look at what a huge customer the government is for everything. I believe the GSA, the federal fleet, is the largest auto fleet in the United States. You know, every year the government buys tens of thousands of cars for its own use. And here's this thing, 175,000 cell phones at one fell swoop, as it were.
Right, exactly. I mean, that's a huge buy, and obviously a boon, I would presume, to any, you know, whoever the vendor is in this case. But yeah, the government is a major, you know, perhaps the largest, you know, individual purchaser of goods and services throughout the country, and its decisions have a lot of impact. You know, along the same lines, last week the General Services Administration announced that it was increasing overall per diem rates by 1.9%. After freezing them last year, and this will be for FY14, or freezing them for this year, and that's you know, something that's closely watched by the hotel, essentially by the hospitality industry, because federal employees, even in these tough times, they still travel, they still spend money on official business, and that business is important to hotels, restaurants, and other companies.
Yeah, it's huge, and the 1.9% increase shows that prices are going up. You know, I went to the FDR conference, Federal Dispute Resolution Conference, in Orlando this year, and the week before that, the Federal Employed Women had their conference, and their attendance was down from about 2,000 to in several hundreds.
Wow.
And for the FDR conference, it was about less than half of what they normally get. And, you know, they can handle this one, maybe even 2 years, but if this kept up, it could do a tremendous amount of damage. And, of course, places like Orlando and Las Vegas and Washington, to some extent, thrive on the tourist business.
They sure do. And, I mean, it's also an indication, I mean, that the impact of federal spending is real and the impact of cutbacks in that spending is real.
The interesting item you have today, the contractor defending the work on the Snowden security checks, and there were contractors that were doing the security checks for both other contract and federal employees of NSA.
Yeah, well, this is something that's getting a lot more scrutiny about, and again, this is a work, this is a story by another colleague, Jim McElhattan, but you know, that the fact that Snowden, you know, who's now responsible for, you know, enormous you know, disclosures of a significant amount of classified information, that he was able to get this, you know, get his clearance, is gotten attention both, you know, from within the executive branch and also in Congress, just how, you know, whether he was adequately vetted, whether there's anything in his record that might have raised a red flag.
Well, you know, they say in this business, when you start quoting yourself, you probably should quit and go take a rest. But I remember writing several years ago at the start of this administration, and they were talking about openness, transparency, and speeding the process up. And one of the things they wanted to do was speed up these security reviews. They were taking several months, 6 months in some cases, and of course the people who were being investigated didn't like to wait. The agencies didn't like to wait. Nobody liked to wait. But the pros said, if we don't do this thoroughly, one step at a time, there's going to be some problems, and it's going to blow up in your face. And apparently it has blown up in their face.
Yeah, the question is, which I don't think has been adequately answered yet, is whether they're, you know, whether it's a, you know, a zero-sum game that you have to have, that you know, these security clearance reviews have to drag out in some cases for a very long time, if that's the only way to prevent you know, mistakes from happening. But, you know, I think it's important to keep in mind, though, that you have almost 5 million, according to the last count from the Director of National Intelligence, people, you know, working directly for the government and for contractors, with clearances. And so it's probably, just by the law of averages, it's inevitable that there are going to be slip-ups along the way.
Right, and there are more top-secret clearances for people outside of government than in it. Mm-hmm. There are more contractors that have it than federal workers that have it.
Yeah, and also the other thing is, of course, now with electronic communications, the fact you can store, you know, vast quantities of information on a memory stick, you can, if you do have a slip-up, the consequence can be much greater than, say, somebody just, you know, say Daniel Ellsberg copying the Pentagon Papers and spiriting them out of the building.
Yeah, that was the old Xerox days when you had pieces of paper, and now it's one flash stick and it's gone across half the world.
Exactly.
Anything you want to kind of wrap up? We've got about a minute and a half.
Sure,
here.
I'd be happy to. Well, one thing I'd just point out that today is, and I know this is a big issue, a big concern for a lot of federal employees. Today is essentially the official kickoff of the 2013 combined federal campaign. Even as we speak, there's a training event going on at the Ronald Reagan Building in downtown D.C. There's a lot of the usual official hoopla with awards and color guard and all that. Office of Personnel Management is still weighing some significant changes to the CFC, probably, the biggest overhaul if they go through with their original blueprint the campaign has seen in decades, that would go to a much more regional approach in terms of how the local federal coordinating committees are structured. It would require all electronic giving. Lots of big changes out there.
Right, and with the pay freeze, too, we'll see what happens. Julia Ziegler is giving me the high sign here, and it's not a friendly wave, so I've got to sign off. Thank you very much, Sean Ronnie. We'll see you here next week, everybody. Have a good week, and be careful.
Thanks, Mike.